Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and we at Shattered Lives are so excited to welcome you to this unique show, taking you beyond the details of the crime and the perpetrator and getting to the heart of what crime victim families experience and what they need in the aftermath of the crime. Prior to each show, please go to www.donnagore.com or imaginepublicity.com to read the background of the case or organization featured the week before our show is aired. And please don't forget, if you can't tune in live from 5 to 6 Eastern, you can tune in at any time using our archival feature. And you can recognize it by going to the Inside Lens group with a big red heart graphic with the cracks. And in about 24 hours after that, our blog and podcast is ready for you at any time, anywhere. So with that, good evening again, and I welcome you from the state of Connecticut where I am. And my able co-host is in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, Delilah. And we have a very good guest. We have a guest who we had on in the spring, and he was so fantastic that I just had to have him on again. And so, you know, that speaks volumes for what we do here and the caliber of guests that we have. And I'm going to bring him on in just a minute or so. Want to make a couple of announcements, and I'll bring in Delilah. Just want to say that for all the people in the Myrtle Beach area, I'd love to collaborate on upcoming projects or be able to utilize this radio show for whatever social issues or crime victimization things that might exist and perhaps vocational opportunities. So please do get in touch with me. I want to congratulate a couple people that I think are soon to be or have just joined the radio show ranks from Imagine Publicity, Dr. Scott Bond, Doc Bond, and soon to be Dr. Alala Corey, I understand, is going to have her show. So I think, you know, this is a really good thing, a way to reach out across the nation, and we surely are glad to have other people. And I want to mention that for all of you are familiar with the situation with Susan Murphy Milano and her stage 4 cancer and what everyone has been trying to do to assist. And the latest effort is an online auction spearheaded by a couple of very, very good people. And I believe if you want to go online and see the treasures that are auctioned off to the highest bidder, I believe it's facebook.com/pages/love-susan if you want to check that out. And that will be a means of helping because her future treatment protocol is going to be very, very expensive. So anything people can do if they know of kind of big hitter donors, we need those too. Now, it's not often that people get the opportunity to do something that speaks to their passion and to help others, and that's why I so love this radio show. And it's really a rarity to have a PR professional that it has your best interest at heart and whom you trust and you really like as a person. And I so respect and so admire Delilah Jones for what she's doing too as a caretaker for Susan. And so I just want to dedicate this show to Delilah and Susan because we are going to talk about the issues of what she may face and what other disenfranchised people face when they face whether it be an illness or a situation of violence or some type of tragedy or loss. And so I just want to say thank you so much, Delilah. It's such a blessing to know you in so many ways, and we all feel blessed. And thank you for being my co-host as well.
Well, I'm always happy to be here. It's a great show that you put on. You get such interesting and great guests, and I've learned so much. And I'm really, really looking forward to diving into this whole subject with Dwayne Bowers, because I think not only myself, but there's probably a lot of people out there that could use his advice. And, you know, perhaps we'll have some people in the chat room that have some questions that need answered as well as me.
Sure.
So I'm excited to get on with the show.
All right. We'll just do that. Let me, Dwayne Bowers has many credentials. I'll just do a very abbreviated version. He's a licensed professional counselor and educator, and he's based in the Washington, D.C. area, although he travels quite a lot, and he specializes in working with survivors of traumatic death, grief, trauma, and suicide, and has worked with a number of very well-known and skilled organizations in many capacities. And I'm sure that, you know, we can bring up some of those in the course of the conversation. So I'll just say, Dwayne, thank you so much for being here again a second time on Shattered Lives. It's an honor.
Well, I'm honored to be here. Thank you for having me and inviting me back, Donna. And hi, Delilah. Good to talk with you again.
Well, I'm so happy you're back.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Were you saying something?
No.
No? Okay.
Sorry.
It's hard sometimes not to talk over people, especially for someone that likes to talk like me. But anyway, Dwayne, the theme that we discussed when we talked on the phone this week was disenfranchised victims. And I think that maybe requires a little bit of explanation, because maybe everyone is not familiar with that term per se when we pair it with crime victims or other people that serve in the capacity or provide support to crime victims or people who are very ill, et cetera. So I wondered if we could start out with that.
Sure. What I was referring to when I was talking about disenfranchised victims is when, you know, when someone has been victimized by a crime or by a situation, you have your victim, and you have that first ring around. And if that victimization actually results, say, in death, then you have that first ring of survivor that everyone kind of focuses on and gives support to. Or even if it doesn't result in death and there is a victim that needs support, you have that first ring. It's usually immediate family or that sort of thing. And everybody kind of focuses on the victim and that first ring of folks. And people forget that there's a second ring, either blood relatives or friends or partners or whatever, that tend to get excluded, who are equally victimized by this crime, by this situation. So let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Let's say you have a situation where perhaps you have a child exploitation situation, where a child is abducted, exploited, trafficked, whatever. You have the child who is the victim, and then you have the parents who everybody, you know, helps to support because they're the next ring. But then you don't think about, like, grandparents and aunts, uncles, siblings, that sort of that next ring around, who are equally victimized, and particularly grandparents, who not only are they watching their grandchild be victimized, but they're also watching their own children trying to have to deal with this, and trying to be supportive of both generations and giving as much as they can, and yet they're often not thought of in the cluster of who is the victim. And
now, do you think that's just out of sight, out of mind kind of thing, Dwayne?
I do. And I think there's a lot of reasons for it. Publicity, number one. Who, you know, when you see the event on news or you hear about it, basically all you hear about is the victim in the first ring. And you don't very often see or hear about that next ring of support. And, you know, there's a lot of levels of disenfranchisement. If you think even further to relationships that are outside the norm, perhaps, for example, say there is a marriage that have been separated for years and years and years, and each of them has a new partner, but something happens to one of those, you go to the married partner, not the outside partner, as next of kin. Same-sex partners, those kinds
of situations. Right, gay and lesbian community, right. Uh-huh.
Absolutely, where they may not be the folks that are getting the support, even though they may be the partner for years and years and years. So I think it's important, and as I expressed to you, perhaps to take some time and talk about how do we support these folks and how do we recognize that these folks even need support. I'm going to add something to that, too. And we didn't talk about this, so I'm going to take you by surprise, Donna. I want to add pets to that as well. Pets go through a process of grieving. Pets go through, they have to live in this chaotic environment as well. And we don't very often think of what that's doing to the pet as well.
And
so I'm just going to add that
in. I don't have a pet, so I didn't necessarily think of that, but it is true. And the card industry has caught up with that aspect, Twain, too.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of,
mm-hmm.
you know, grieving over your pet kind of thing.
Absolutely. But also just recognizing that pet needs some support. The pet picks up on the anxiety that's going on in the family when something happens and needs some kind of support, too. And very often what happens is the cat or the dog or the pet starts acting out. And doing actually very much like a small child, regressing in behavior, may have some difficulty with housebreaking and whatever, and going back into old behaviors, acting out, and then that just adds to the stress of the first ring victim. But we don't think, well, the reason they're acting out is they're not getting the support they need.
Right. Well, that is so true, and I know that when we were sort of framing this too, we thought that initially it might be helpful to discuss some of the behaviors and symptoms that, you know, victims exhibit or go through when they encounter tragedy or violence or terminal illness, if, you know, as well as what behavior symptoms are common among the victim or the quote-unquote support family or staff.
Right.
Can you maybe identify some of that as an initial starting point?
Absolutely. We talk about the traumatic response, and we think in terms of post-traumatic stress disorder and that sort of thing. What we don't realize is the traumatic response really is physiological, and then the behaviors come from that. So what happens is we tend to flood with cortisol, which then the first thing it does is it affects the part of our brain known as the hippocampus. You actually have two of those things. They're called hippocampi. And they're your short-term memory and your learning. When you're under a great deal of stress, when you're having a reaction to a traumatic event, your hippocampus actually gets interfered with, so it's hard to concentrate, hard to remember. And, in fact, people who are involved directly in the event, if it's a criminal event or whatever, very often forget parts of it. They'll come out of it saying, oh, my God, I can't remember the whole thing. I can remember the stuff of the high intensity, but I don't remember
details. Right.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's exactly what's supposed to happen. Actually, your brain is designed to do that, and it does it to keep you alive. What happens is your brain shuts down the short-term memory so that the part of your brain called the amygdala, which is your fear center, can actually function and make you keep alert as to what do I need to do to stay alive. So you only take in the stuff that's relative to how do I stay alive, how do I deal with what's in front of me right now. And you do tend to forget those details. And if that stress is prolonged, that keeps up. That lack of concentration, that lack of ability to remember, to learn new things, whatever. And so this is why very often in those kinds of situations we suggest that a person kind of keep a friend with them or someone with them who can kind of jot down details and that sort of thing so that when they need them, somebody else did hear them and has them written down and whatever, because we know they're not going to pick up all of the details. And, you know, when you're in a crime scene or whatever, it's police, it's ambulances, it's go to the hospital, it's go to the police station, it's just all of this stuff. And lots of stuff is told to you that you may not remember. Another mm-hmm. symptom is that your immune system shuts down. And so what happens is that you run on adrenaline for a while, and that kind of keeps you going. But once the adrenaline runs out, you start catching everything that happens. And you'll notice this a lot with folks who are going through traumatic events. As soon as their health seems to be fine, but as soon as the event is over and they kind of take a breath, boom, they're sick.
Or get a chronic illness. I can relate to that one too, from the immune system. I won't mention what it is, but it's sort of a pain in the neck.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
well, and you just mentioned something else. You just mentioned pain in the neck. You know, your immune system actually releases the painkillers all the time in your system. If you didn't have an immune system, you'd be amazed at how much pain your body is actually experiencing. Well, when the immune system shuts down, you are much more aware of all of that pain in your body, and then add to it the pain that comes with the stress. And so, yes, people find themselves experiencing more pain as
a
result.
Or diseases, yes. Right. Well, and all that's meant to protect you. Is it variable in terms of after the acute phase of the trauma, when the short-term memory starts to come back and they start to remember the details?
Oh, now see, that's the thing. When your short-term memory starts functioning again, you're never going to remember those details. The stuff when your hippocampus is shut down, it's not that you've taken it in and you just don't remember it. It doesn't get in at all. So you're never going to remember some of those details. Now, once it starts functioning again, then you start picking up details as of now, but you don't ever remember that stuff that got blocked when you were going through it. Here's the problem, though. If I have in my mind some horrible traumatic pictures, I saw it happen or I've created these traumatic pictures in my head, every time those pictures come into my mind, it sets off the body again so that I start letting cortisol out into my system again, and then it'll interfere with my hippocampus again. This is what post-traumatic stress disorder is all about. Flashbacks, dreams, nightmares, those kinds of things cause me to just start that whole process over again, and I can't concentrate. I can't remember things that are happening now, et cetera. So I lose my keys. I miss appointments, those kinds of things. And they become more and more frustrating. Of course, the more frustrated I become, the more anxious I become, the worse the symptoms become. So,
yes, it sounds like a vicious cycle for sure. And how you break that or how you get out of that cycle, I don't know. I'm trying to recall from our earlier discussion, at what point would we introduce counseling or, seeing a counselor?
That can happen really pretty much at any point. It's not going to be very effective immediately afterwards,
right.
Just because they're still busy with the stuff of the event. But I'll tell you the things they can start introducing. See, it's that cortisol level that's really throwing your body off. And if you can start bringing that cortisol down, that can be helpful. So, you know, one of the first things we always talk about is exercise, and I'm aware of the fact that if the client did not exercise before the event, they're probably not going to exercise after. But anything like just walking or just some basic movement stuff will actually start to bring down that cortisol level so they can start functioning better.
Or finding time in your day to do, to even take a 15, 20, 30-minute walk.
Yeah.
And when you're slap dab in the middle of everything that's going on around
it's
you,
hard.
It's like you have an extra 15 to 30 minutes, you want to just lay down and take a nap.
You just want to shut it down, absolutely.
I understand the importance of it, though.
Yeah. Exercise. Actually, there are a lot of things that feeling good about yourself. I don't want to say this and say that people should do this, but chocolate actually releases endorphins, which bring down cortisol levels. I'm not saying go out and eat a ton of chocolate, but it does help as far as bringing down cortisol levels. Actually, laughing. And I know people say, well, what do I have to laugh about? I'm dealing with a trauma. Just pretending to laugh, your brain doesn't know the difference between pretending to laugh and real laughter. So if you just sit and go, ha, 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 for 5 minutes, actually that will release endorphins into your system and bring down your cortisol levels.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So your brain is so plastic. It can be manipulated in so many ways that, and tricked in so many ways that are helpful. That there are many of those kinds of things that, you know, sing in the shower, dance, and, you know, sing in the car, you know, those kinds of, all of that helps to release endorphins and bring down cortisol levels. So
you pick whatever is pleasurable and kind of try to incorporate that into your day, whether it's getting up a half hour early and taking a walk, or you have to do it for your health. You just have to.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. And you really should stay away. And you should stay away from stimulants in that point in time, too, immediately after a trauma. Like, stay away from caffeines and sugars and that sort of thing that are false stimulants for your body, because when you crash even harder when you have high levels of cortisol in your body.
Yeah.
So trying to keep away from those things. Eating natural sugars like fruits and that sort of thing are much better than putting sugar in your drinks or whatever.
Yeah. Do you think that the
we don't see enough of is the fact that, you know, anyone who's going through a serious illness is going to have someone, whether family, friend, whomever, is going to be a caregiver. Why don't more doctor's offices become more aware of those needs and all of the things that you've just described? I mean, give them a pamphlet, give them something. It's very rare that you go to an appointment with someone and a lot of times you're just kind of put over in the corner and the exam goes on and yada, yada, yada. Fortunately, you know, we haven't had that experience because I won't allow it, but I've heard it from a lot of people.
Well, I will say this. There are hospitals and, like, Kaiser Permanente, who is where I have my medical care, and hospitals in this area, in the Washington, D.C. area, that have classes for caregivers. And you come in and they talk about the concerns and talk about the self-care stuff for the caregiver and the things that you look out for as a caregiver. But you have to know about them. You have to be on the mailing list or whatever to know that they're having these classes to benefit from them. I'll tell you who does some really good caregiver stuff are hospices. And even if the person you're caring for isn't in the process of dying, you can hook into some of those hospice classes, and they can they provide very often some good caregiver support.
You can still partake even if that's not the situation. Well, I agree with Delilah. I think it's so needed because typically the whole focus is on the patient or the person who's been victimized, and you don't want to be put off in a corner. And I'm wondering, when you talk about the first ring and then the second ring, does the second ring, meaning the second tier or whatnot, if it's the caregiver, the uncle, the grandparent, the step-parent, do they have the same, typically the same type of response in terms of what their body does as the people who are experiencing it, you know, the first ring?
Absolutely they can. And, of course, it depends on the relationship and how close the relationship is and that sort of thing, but absolutely they can. In fact, and I'm going to get a little technical here, but for mental health professionals, our Bible is called the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical
Right.
Manual of Mental Health Disorders. Right now, the definition of post-traumatic stress disorder says you have to see the event or see it happen to someone else. In the new one that's coming out in 2013, all you have to do is hear about the event happening to someone you care about, and that will be considered exposure. So even in the way that we diagnose it is going to change come May next year.
And a new medical category for insurance reimbursement?
We're not going to go there.
We would only hope. Why can't we get the same services for the caretakers or that second ring of people? I mean, it should be there.
Well,
no?
That
it
would
should.
Mean higher insurance rates, wouldn't it? Because the insurance company certainly isn't going to do that for free.
Well,
so
I know, but I would pay for those people. I really would.
Yeah. Yeah,
if they're helping me to maintain my health or, you know, trying to help me, then, you know, Look at personal care attendants. I'm in the process of writing a blog about, you know, those people are so underpaid. People in human services that deal with severely disabled people every day and do the independent living tasks that they're not able to do. They're very underpaid and under-acknowledged with respect to that. I just think it's a tragedy. Why should we aspire, you know, we put all the attention on IT people and engineers and lawyers and doctors, but yet the people that do the very, you know, worthy stuff to help save humanity, Dwayne, they're just, you know, they're not paid attention to, and it drives me crazy.
Yeah, I hear you. You know, one other thing that I'd like to mention is what's known in the hospice world as respite care. Hospices often, even if you're having home hospice care, if it's a hospice that has its own beds, they will have beds available so that person that's getting home care can actually come into the hospice facility for a weekend or a week or whatever and give the caregivers a break for that week or whatever.
Respite. Yeah.
Respite care. And I think that's something we should really be focusing on for situations that, even if it's not a terminal illness, but respite care for any caregiver who is or anyone who is supporting a family that is going through trauma or going through a crime situation or whatever, that they have a place to go and get away and have someone else be able to come in and cover for them, as the case may be. And actually, you can kind of set that up in your own extended family if you've got a good, strong family network that you can do that, kind of drawing like maybe cousins and that sort of thing who are not first ring or second ring to come in and do some care provision while I take a break for a day or two. But again, these are things we need to teach people how to do, and it's not often that you can find those kinds of classes on how do you do that and how do you approach people, et cetera.
Well, there are some structured programs, too. For instance, with the state of Connecticut through Department of Social Services, even if you're on Medicaid, if you qualify and you're of a certain age, 60 or 65, there are respite programs that will be paid for, you know, entitlement programs for respite care for family members as well. So that may be another alternative.
Yeah, but again, look, you have to be at a certain age and whatever.
Yes,
so if you're a young family that the child's just been exploited, abducted, you just got them back, the parents just need a break for a couple of days, they don't qualify for that.
No, and many times.
Don't you find too that a lot of the victim service providers, and this is coming from the chat room, how can they become highly skilled in working with victims of extreme violence when they're often themselves survivors and came out of an inadequate care system for that type of an event or experience? So what they're saying is we see a lot of things, just for example, Dwayne, we talked earlier about Project Jason, a wonderful organization, and a lot of the missing persons organization, it seems, come out of a family member. So, and they're so giving, they're so willing to give back because they've been so well supported in some cases, and I think it's just wonderful. However, you know, we have someone like Kelly Jokowski. Who's supporting her with respite? Where, you know, and others too. I mean, there's tons of them out there.
Right, and that's why programs like the retreat that Project Jason does every year are so valuable. It's because the people who come to that are families whose loved ones have been missing for a number of years. And these very often, now I'm not saying all are, but many of them are people who have started their own nonprofits and are doing much like Kelly is doing. But they just need a weekend to focus on them and their feelings and where are they now. You know, you start an organization and you work for 2 or 3 years so focused on it, you don't even realize where have I come to in my own adjustment to my loved one missing or if they are deceased, to my own grief, because you get all caught up in everybody else's stuff. So, you need those kinds of moments to come away for maybe a weekend and just say, okay, let me focus on me for a little while.
On me, yeah. And it's so rare that you do. You're so busy, like you say, focusing on other people. And I can definitely relate to that, too.
It's amazing how much difference 48 hours can make. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's that long of a time span, but in 48 hours can mean all the difference in, you know, a time to rest, a time to get your mind off things, a time, you know, a time to just be you.
And Kelly's very good at doing things like throwing in massage and stress management classes at the same time in those things. I would welcome, you know, acupuncture is something that people are starting to really become aware of how beneficial it can be, because acupuncture actually releases endorphins into your system, and it's the endorphins that bring down those cortisol levels. So a lot of these alternatives that have been around for, you know, centuries, are also good at helping people to get control over these symptoms of stress and whatever. But again, it means taking an hour out of your day to do it.
Yeah. And sometimes people just think, oh, well, it's just not worth the trouble, or make excuses. So we end up not doing it, which is, you know, just detrimental to us. But can you tell us about what the role is of the various extended family members that we spoke of, perhaps, you know, whether it be grandparents or step parents? I know you had just come from a conference with the Center for Missing and Exploited Children, correct? And just what should their role be in this whole scenario when a trauma happens or a severe illness, as opposed to, you know, what does happen?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the number one roles for extended family, that's aunts, uncles, and grandparents, is focusing on the kids in that family that's in turmoil. In other words, let's say the family's experienced a homicide or a suicide or some traumatic event, and what's happened here is that the parents are dealing with the trauma. They're dealing with the police. They're dealing with whatever is necessary. And very often the kids in that family are kind of left to their own devices because the parents are so focused on whatever the trauma is. I'll tell you specifically, parents of missing children, I've had many parents of missing children tell me when their child was missing, they actually abandoned their other children because they just had to find the missing one. And they knew at the time they were doing it, but they just couldn't stop themselves. This is where the role of the extended family comes in, to be able to help support those kids when mom and dad are focusing on whatever that traumatic event is. And coming in and cooking an occasional meal, coming in and doing laundry occasionally, doing those daily things that now have become major obstacles because I'm so focused on caregiving, I'm so focused on whatever the issue is. To stop and do laundry, when do I have time to do that? Stop and cook a meal, when do I have time to do that? And so having extended family be able to come in and just fill those kinds of roles, or sit with the kids and do their homework with them, or even take them out and go do something with them, again, respite, get them away from the environment for a little while, it becomes a very important role. The problem is when you do have a good family where that extended family is coming in and doing that, they don't get recognized for the work that they're doing. And they may end up taking on a big load that is just kind of, like I said, disenfranchised. No one's really recognizing the level of stress that's now been placed on them as they've moved in to fill in those roles. And so we need to be able to say to them, when's the last time, you know, you went and got your hair done? When's the last time, if you know my picture, that's one of my favorite things. And for anyone who hasn't seen my picture, I'm bald. So,
that's okay.
When's the last time you did something for you?
So
we need to focus on those folk as well, because that's what I'm talking about. They're the ones that tend to be disenfranchised. They're involved. They're putting their time and energy into helping support the family, but they're not getting support themselves.
Do you think that a majority or at least that some of them are waiting to be asked or given direction about what to do, or they typically will jump in and then see that, you know, this isn't done, that isn't done, and take on too much? I mean, many times they are, you know, these are elder people doing things mm-hmm. that they did many years ago for their own children, and
exactly.
it can be a physical and a mental strain. So
absolutely.
how do you deal with those things?
Absolutely. Well, I think, first of all, you have to look at the family unit. There are families who are not particularly close, who are not very supportive, that if the grandparents
right.
or that ring came in and said, oh, here, I'm going to help, it might be perceived as they're trying to take over. So, you know, there's family dynamics. We all have families.
Right.
We all know that we're not the, you know, the Huxtables or the Ozzie and Harriets. So there are those issues. Then there are families who, shoot, we've come back and we live with Grandma and Grandpa. So they're already there to provide that. They're already doing it on pretty much a daily basis already. So in some situations, it's easier for the extended family to be part of because they're already included in some way. And in others, it does become an issue of, well, how much am I allowed to be a part of this? And I don't want, you know, I don't want to cause more friction to be part of it and that sort of thing as well. But again, we need to look at that ring, that second or third ring, and be able to say, and I think this is where good friends, clergy, mental health folks need to really stop and say, you know, we're so focused on looking at the victim in that first ring, we forget to step back and say to the grandparents, so how are you holding up, or the aunts and uncles, or the partner that is being excluded for whatever reason. How are you holding up, and how's that ticking? Who's helping you, and what do you need? What kinds of things can we do to help support you? And very often they won't even know, but just, you know, just being there and talking. Just sit, you know what, let me take you to coffee. Let me take you to Starbucks, and let's just sit and chat for an hour. Can you imagine what that could be for somebody? How supportive
yeah.
that could be. Just have a place to vent. You know?
Definitely. I think it's very helpful for all of us when we're dealing with these situations. But we have to create those opportunities for people that we care about to do this. And sometimes maybe they just feel like, oh, well, I don't want to complain and I'll just say everything is okay. But you know in your heart of hearts that they're dealing with big burdens as well. And, you know, what is it that you think both the victims and the people in the second or third ring or caregivers, what is it that maybe they most need and they never seem to get? And I'm either speaking with respect to down the road, whether it be counseling or other things, is it just someone to kind of give them a little boost with their quality of life at that particular moment?
Well, of course, I'm a therapist, so you know where I'm going to come from. But I think
yeah.
that victims, I think every circle, including the victim, does not get enough mental health support when they need it. And so they start to create neural networks in their brain or whatever that are detrimental to them. And then when they finally do get start to see that, oh my God, I'm not dealing right. I'm having trouble. I'm having flashbacks. I'm having dreams, nightmares. I need some help. It's months down the road. And if they were to get that support within, I'd say 4 weeks, 4 to 8 weeks, if they started getting their support, a lot of that stuff wouldn't happen. But then again, I got to say, they have to be careful who they're getting their support from. Those folks need to know what they're doing and how to help them. But
not to go to,
you know,
the corner bar, right?
Yeah, little things like crying. Some new research about crying. Crying, we always think crying is, oh, they're emotional and they're in pain and that sort of thing. Well, that can be true, but the tears themselves, actually some research is starting to say when a person's perspective shifts, so in other words, I'm doing okay all through the day and then I finally realize, oh my God, I'm in the process of dying. My perception has just shifted in a major way. And your body needs to react to that somehow. And if you can't move, if you can't run, if you can't do something physical, then the way it's going to come out is in tears. So while there is pain, what we really don't recognize is there's been a major change in perspective. And the thing I need most is somebody to let me talk about that fear. And what is it that they come in? They come in and say, oh, don't cry, everything will be okay. Well, thanks a lot. You know, that
no, isn't it?
You know?
It's a physical release when you cry, right? And therefore
exactly.
Therapeutic.
So most people are uncomfortable when they see their loved ones cry, so they want them to stop. You know, oh, don't cry, it'll be okay. And they don't say, let that out and let's talk about what was it you were just thinking about. You're afraid to die? Well, let's talk about that. And, of course, it's because the caregiver really is uncomfortable with that topic, too. But that's really what they need. So a good mental health person understands that, could be educating the second ring and the family, and also providing the support that's necessary to the victim. And mental health support can be a good clergyman, elder deacon from the church if they're faith-based. It doesn't have to be a counselor, though I would recommend that, but somebody who is trained in how to support people can be that person. They just need
right.
to know what to do and what to say.
And when we encounter, as we have seen in our research with Susan, and there's so many thousands of people that are uninsured and therefore do
yeah.
not qualify for, you know, in counseling by just here's my insurance, that wouldn't they tend to turn to clergy or, you know, maybe some other, you know, fee for service type of thing.
Absolutely.
And getting those needs met, right?
Absolutely, but I will tell you this. Back in the 70s here in D.C., D.C. went through a really major economic problem, the city. And so we have lots of churches. And the churches stepped in and actually started providing a lot of the social welfare needs, a lot of the social services. They even started hiring social workers and stuff to provide for those needs, which
mm-hmm.
worked pretty well. But then what happened was they started getting sued. When things would go wrong. And so when you turn to a lot of clergy, in fact, in D.C., the law is a clergy person can do three counseling sessions if the sessions are focused on something other than spiritual direction. So if it's about grief or if it's about, you know, marriage or whatever, they can do three sessions, but then they have to stop and they have to refer to a mental health professional. So you may find that clergy are hesitant to get into a kind of counseling role because they can only do a certain number and they can be sued for counseling without a license because most clergy are not trained counselors. So,
right.
you know, that's...
Is that just
there
in
is,
your area or does that pertain to any...
I think that's true probably in many places that
okay.
Clergy are very limited in what they can do. And so while you would think, okay, there's someone who could fill that role, there may be liable issues that make them hesitant to do that. So I'm also giving the reason why you may not see that happen, even though it seems like a natural order to things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
I think shows like this, where we're talking about it and we're talking about a few of the things to look for and a few of the things that can be helpful and just, you know, sitting and having coffee with somebody and how amazing that can be. I think these kinds of experiences for people who are listening, this is a vital part of what you do, Donna and Delilah. This education, folks may not be getting from anywhere else. So this is a good place for folks to say, oh, I hadn't thought about that next ring out. Gee, let me go call Grandma and see how she's doing. I know she's been doing a lot of work with them lately. So maybe...
Not only that, Duane, but it's also getting out the information about what types of resources and for people put into certain positions to think about, because it's one of those things where you're thrust into it at such a fast speed with no prior experience, whether it be a missing child or being a caregiver. You know, you're going into it every day is like a new experience for you. You don't know if what you did is right or wrong. You just know you have to do it. So I think shows like this are bringing that education and awareness out to the public. And it's so needed. It really is.
Absolutely. I'm going to kind of turn the roles here and ask you, Delilah, what are you finding is for your own care is the hardest thing? The if you can stop and think for a minute what you're doing to support yourself, what's hardest for you?
It's time. It's the time. Mm-hmm. It's because, like you explained earlier in the show, you're always on go. There's very little time to just put it on the pause button and go out and take a walk or go out and have coffee or, you know, meet up with friends. I mean, I try to do that as much as possible, and I do have some wonderful friends that drag me out. So,
you know. There you go.
And
no, that's excellent.
But it is. It's the time to do everything you have to do. And luckily, I work from home. If I had to, you know, go to a job somewhere else every day and punch in, I don't know that I could do this. And I don't know how people who work full time outside of the home do it. You know, I'm fortunate in that aspect. But still, even then, the time to do the things that you know you have to do, it seems like there just isn't enough. I need 40 hours in a day, not a week.
Yeah, I hear you. Absolutely. But, you know, those friends who drag you out, that's what I'm talking about. They're the ones that need the education. Grab two of you, go to the house. One of you stay, the other one take her out. And that way someone's there and someone's got you and they take you out for an hour and you go get your nails done. You go get, go get a massage, you go do something. And someone's covering, so if they need you, they've got, you know, we've got cell phones today. We didn't have those years ago. They can reach you in minutes.
And we got a few birthday gifts that she could utilize, too. That's just for her.
Absolutely.
There you go.
Massage, things like that. Right, Delilah?
Yeah, there again, it's fine. It's making the time. It's, you know, there. And then, too, you get your own mental state goes into places that you're not used to being. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
And
that's
very,
where counseling can help. Now, let me tell you this, and folks don't think about this as much. There are some wonderful crisis lines out there that are there. That's what they're there for, is when you just need to talk to somebody, 4 o'clock in the morning, whatever, they're staffed 24 hours a day, and very often they do have resources that they can make you aware of that you may not have known of, and there's some really excellent ones. I'm not saying that one's better than the others, but the one that I have had really good feedback on is Crisis Link, and it's an 800 number, and folks can just call them at any time and just talk and just say, you know, my head is going in places I've never gone before. I just need to talk this through with someone. So we tend to think that they're all, supposedly suicide lines or whatever. No, they're there to talk. And their people who answer those phones get an incredible amount of training. So, and then have lists of resources that they can tell you and other numbers and whatever. So don't forget about that as a resource as well, for folks who are caregivers or that second or third circle where you just don't have the time, but you can stop for a minute and just call and say, I just need to talk to somebody. That can be a good resource.
Yeah, that sounds good. That sounds like one I didn't think of. And I think there is that stereotype that, crisis links are just for suicide, but you said they're not. What about the idea that if you're a close family member or you're a friend and you're trying, you know, you see that the person is needing help, but yet maybe they don't want to hear that from you because of your relationship or you know, you don't really know how to approach it, or, you know, you want to kind of nip the situation in the bud before that grandparent or that uncle or that caregiver gets sick themselves. I mean, how can you step in appropriately and say, no, you have to stop. You have to stop.
One of the things about families is we tend to not think that our family members know what they're talking about. It's sort of that, that's my mother. She really doesn't know what she's talking about. She doesn't know that anything about this is going to make me sick or whatever. So sometimes it takes coercing a third person in. This is another good place that clergy, talking to friends and asking the friends to talk to them and reason with them, that sort of thing, because you know your relationship. If they're not going to hear you,
right,
it's your obligation to try to tell them, hey, I'm here to help, and this you're headed down a self-destructive way. But if they're not going to listen, then get somebody in there that they might listen to who can say, well, let your mom do the laundry. If you don't want her with the kids, fine, let her do the laundry. At least that'll help. And they're more likely sometimes to listen to friends than they are to family members. But the bottom line is to just be there and just be watching. And when those things start to fall apart, just kind of pick up and do them. Sometimes in a relationship, I have so much pride that I'm not about to say, yes, I need help with my laundry. But if I turn around and you've done it, yeah, I may fuss, but bottom line is I'm so glad it's done. I don't have to worry about it anymore. You know?
Right.
Go ahead.
Very good to do those things. Many families also are not geographically focused in the same area, and I would imagine
right.
You know, whether it's, you know, here I am in my state, but yet my loved one is in, you know, two states beyond, or whether it's that or caretaker. So it's very hard to do that from a different location, too. But I'm sure you develop your own little systems and circles and make sure that you designate somebody there to go in and do the day-to-day, and maybe you can do other things, or you can even mail packages to people.
Absolutely.
You know, little care
packages.
I've done that.
Yep.
You know, I try to do those kind of things too. It's just it's so very important, because what happens if those second and third tier people, third ring people, if they get physically sick? And you know, we haven't really talked about people who, for instance, have Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia, and they have, before they are, you know, put in a skilled nursing facility or whatnot, typically there are, before they get to a particular stage, you know, family members are charged to do that, and it's a very hard situation, and they may be, you know, somewhat elderly themselves and develop physical symptoms. I'm just wondering, when the tragedy is sort of a medical nature, is that very different than when we're talking about a missing person or a homicide in terms of how you should approach it, Duane?
It's very different in the way that the mental health field would diagnose it, because long-term illness is not considered a trauma. A trauma is an event, not a long-term illness. So
okay.
The way the mental health world would approach it is, okay, these are symptoms of anxiety. But the bottom line is, no, the same thing's happening inside your body as is happening to somebody who's facing trauma. And your behaviors are going to be the same. The way you need to be supported is the same, even though you may have to diagnose it differently. So the point is, it's only different in the name that you call it, but it's essentially the same. They need the same kind of support. I want to add something to what you just said. So now you have an event, and you've got your first, second, and third ring of folks who are supporting it. But in the third ring, here's Grandma, who now is getting a little bit older, and Grandma now starts needing some support herself. She falls, breaks a hip, whatever. Where are the family that would normally be supportive to Grandma? They're in the first and second ring supporting this trauma. So when something else happens, it adds additional stress to that family, and there's not the resources available within the family to help support Grandma that she needs. And then, like you said,
that's when they turn to institutional care then, right? Because they become overwhelmed with the degree of trauma in that particular family unit.
And,
right?
And then what happens is Grandma becomes disenfranchised. She's put in she's put in some kind of a care facility. Everybody's focused on this other event in the family, and you know, Grandma or Grandpa or whoever is not getting the support that they need. And so again, having a good, I'm going to say, mental health person coming into that family environment and saying, "All right, we need to set up some delegation of services here, and we need to set up some structure so that everybody's getting the support they need rather than just this one event over here. Here's another thing to consider. When there's a lot of high stress going into a family for a long period of time, stress reduces your immune system. We all have cancerous cells in our body. When your immune system is not functioning, those cancerous cells get to start taking over. And often you will see in families of stress who have had homicide, suicide, missing child, whatever, and a few months down the road, suddenly these more drastic diagnoses start coming up, and it's all stress-related. So helping that family to deal with that stuff while it's happening is really important.
Who would be the professional that should step in to identify that the mental health professional is needed now, especially if you're dealing with more than one kind of crisis?
Well, that's the thing. A good doctor should be able to say, you know what, you need to be getting some support on the side here. But doctors tend to
see the big picture.
Yeah, I don't mean to make a generalization here, because some doctors, and especially the younger ones, are understanding the need for mental health support more. But the medical profession believes that you can treat almost everything with a pill. So, oh, you're anxious? Let me give you an anti-anxiety med. Well, that's not really helping to solve the problem. It's just giving you meds. And if your body reacts to the meds in a negative way, it just adds to the anxiety. So there you go.
Yeah,
and a lot of the... I want to say something about sleep medication while we're talking about
sure.
that. A lot of folks can't sleep immediately after a trauma, immediately after a death, or if they're a caregiver, half of them stays awake because they're afraid they're going to be needed in the night. So often they will turn to a sleep med. What a lot of folks are finding is if the sleep medication does not allow you to dream, you wake up more exhausted than if you didn't sleep at all. Dreaming is the way that we let out stress at night. And a lot of these meds that are very popular, that are prescription meds, shut down the part of the brain that allows you to dream. And so if you can't dream and release a lot of that stuff, you wake up exhausted. So,
interesting.
So a lot of times that sleep med is not the best cure for someone who's not sleeping, and they end up even more exhausted.
So what do you say? Is it we've got about maybe almost 3 minutes left in our show. Is it exercise right before you go to bed? Go on the stationary bike or something so you can go to sleep.
Well, and it's a matter of that could help, but for some people exercise actually stimulates them. I exercise in the morning and I'm good for the day. You know, so to exercise would keep me awake. But one of the things that we forget about is, your retina actually controls your sleep, and your retina, when there's light, will release serotonin, which wakes you up. But when it gets dark, it releases melatonin, which causes you to sleep.
Right.
So you want to start shutting down lights, you know, half hour, 45 minutes before bedtime. Just start making it your environment darker.
Dark.
And, you know, start relaxing your body rather than pumping it up. By that I mean exhaling longer than you're inhaling. So do a few minutes of relaxation breathing where you inhale on the count of three but exhale on the count of four, so you leave more depressants in your system. And just start training your body in that way that, hey, we're heading to bed. I'm also a hypnotherapist, and the more that you plant these thoughts and do them in a habitual way, then your body starts going, oh, look, 8:30, we need to start slowing down for bed. But you got to teach your brain and your body to do it. So, and it takes 21 days to form a new habit. So you've got to practice putting your body to sleep for 21 days before it'll start trying to do it on its own.
Wow. Well, you know, you've certainly given us a lot to think about and a lot of homework assignments here, and that's kind of what I like, because, you know, I had 7 years of college and university, and I remember that. But we have to say, you know, this has been a wealth of information, I think, on a very focused topic, and I think we could talk an hour more. So we'll have to have you back a third time in a few months, Dwayne. I would love it if, you know, we should create a seminar amongst our group here. Maybe we can talk about that. I'd love to do something like that with you. And I have all these national witnesses, too. But in any case, I think that you've shown a light on several populations that really don't get that, and I think we should take this information. I'm going to try to do you justice in my blog and the podcast afterwards and distribute it, but we have to keep this in mind, and we have to care for those second and third wing people and our caretakers, because if we don't have them, then the people that really need them, they're sunk. So, and that's about, you know, that this is the aftermath of the crime and what our mission is. So I want to thank you so much for a wonderful show. Delilah, thank you. And I will talk to each of you soon. And until next Saturday, thank you, our national audience. And I look forward to talking to you next Saturday. Good evening.